Well, we only made it through five slides so far, I think. Yeah, we're on slide six. And in slide six, what we see in the graph of blood volume versus fluid intake is that the kidneys do very well at compensating for a lot of fluid intake, much more than you need, whereas they do not very well a job at all if you have too reduced a fluid intake. So on the low end, notice how steeply it drops off. The kidneys can't compensate for a severe shortage of fluid. On the other hand, if you drink way more than you need, the kidneys respond very well simply by getting rid of almost all that water by diuresis. Kind of makes sense, right? You can't just create water. It has to be there to begin with, but if you have too much, there's steps you can take to get rid of it. All right, let's go to seven. The graphs here are comparing solute concentrations in blood plasma on the top and intracellular fluid on the bottom, as you see. And one important thing here is that the yellow bar, which is the total osmolarity, is the same in both extracellular fluid and intracellular fluid. In other words, both the extracellular fluid and the intracellular fluid are of the same wateriness, right? They have the same overall solute concentration, but as the green bars indicate, they have totally different concentrations of individual solutes. So extracellular fluid and intracellular fluid are different chemically, but there is no osmotic gradient between them. And this agrees with what we've already talked about, right? Water travels from one compartment to the next down an osmotic gradient, if it exists, until there's equilibrium. But just because the two compartments are the same wateriness does not mean that they are the same chemically, because there are totally different arrangements of solutes in those two compartments. And you already know this, of course, but let's go through it again. In the extracellular fluid, the major ion is sodium. Notice they're all listed on the bottom graph, but they all the bars correspond to each other within the same column. Sodium dominates the solutes in the extracellular fluid, whereas there's not much of it in the intracellular fluid. Just the opposite situation for potassium. It dominates the solutes in the intracellular fluid, not very much of it in the extracellular fluid. Well, you know the answer to why. What is that? What did you say proudly? Why are you so quiet? We're working as a class here. Say it to the class. All right, no participation points then. Anyone else want to answer this confidently? Why do you have high sodium outside the cells and low sodium inside? Yes, the sodium-potassium exchange pumps are continuously working in all your cells. And that pump is actually a dual pump, right? There's that single protein, the sodium-potassium exchange pump, works as a pump for two different solutes in two different directions. So it's continuously pumping potassium into the cell and pumping sodium out of the cell, and that's the reason that there is such a difference in concentrations for these two solutes. Why is that important, by the way? What is sodium important for, especially the fact that it's being pumped? Water does follow it, so sodium is the major reason why water flows osmotically from where it does to where it does, depending on the situation. That's true. Chloride, by the way, which is the major anion in the extracellular fluid, it's the other big bar, chloride is there in abundance in the extracellular fluid, not because it's pumped, but because it follows sodium as well, since sodium is a positive ion and chloride is a negative ion. So sodium chloride, both ions, but the ionic compound, sodium chloride, is rich in the extracellular fluid, and that's really the main driver of osmosis into the extracellular fluid. But back to why we operate these pumps. What are the pumps good for? Yes, they establish the gradients, but why? We've talked about it in here and in Bio 201 pretty extensively. Yeah, for one thing, the sodium-potassium pump is responsible for maintaining membrane potentials in any cell, all your cells, not just the excitable cells. All your living cells have a membrane potential because there is an uneven distribution of ions on one side versus the other. And since those ions are carrying charge, that means there's an unequal distribution of charge, which is a voltage. A voltage is a gradient with respect to electrostatic charge. But what is that good for? Why bother to do that? Well, in excitable cells, that voltage can change, right, pretty drastically by allowing certain ions to flow into or out of the cell at particular times. This is the basis for action potentials, which is a 201 topic. In other words, your entire nervous system and muscular system operate on the basis of moving sodium and chloride and into or out of the cells through channels that get opened at different times to create those action potentials. So that's a truly important function of these ions just by itself. But why do you have this happening in other cells that aren't excitable? Why bother to run the pumps there? Because these pumps account for about 40% of your overall energy budget, the reason that you eat. They're expensive to run. Each cycle of the pump requires ATP. Why are you doing this in non-excitable cells? This answer you should know even better, because it was much more recently that we talked about this as one example. Well, ATP powers the pumps. So you don't pump the sodium in order to make ATP. You actually spend AP to make the pumps move sodium and potassium in the way it does. So why would you do that? It would be a waste of ATP if there weren't a reason for having these gradients. Why pump sodium out of the cell so that there's a steep gradient? Other than for excitable cells to have action potentials. No idea? No. What was the last chapter about? I figured that would be an easy question. What was the last chapter's... The what system? Not the respiratory system. That was two chapters ago. Urinary system. Right. Isn't that a hint as to why you want to pump sodium? I mean, there's many reasons, but the urinary system provides a good example. When sodium gets pumped and it creates a gradient, allowing that sodium to diffuse back into the cell that it got pumped out of can allow for other things to be dragged along for the ride. Remember, we talked about various kinds of solutes moving through membranes along with sodium? And that's how they get secondarily actively transported? Well, that wouldn't happen if you didn't have that sodium gradient to begin with. So you spend the energy in terms of ATP to establish the gradient by operating the pumps. That's primary active transport. And then symporters or co-transporters, either symporters or antiporters, can move other things against their gradient by allowing sodium to come back into the cell down its gradient. That's secondary active transport. And that occurs not just in the kidneys, that was just a good example, This is a major way in which you can get things into or out of the cell by coupling the transport of those things to the transport of sodium down its own gradient. And without that gradient in place, first of all, that wouldn't happen. And you establish that gradient because of the pumps. Potassium is also important for other reasons, including it's a cofactor for certain proteins. It makes them effective. Magnesium and inorganic phosphate are richer also inside the intracellular fluid than extracellular fluid, as you see here by the bars. But potassium inside the cell is the dominant ion. Sodium is the dominant ion in the extracellular fluid. Same wateriness, though, in both compartments, because water, osmosis, if there is a difference. Okay, now to 8, and we are revisiting aldosterone here in this slide. What is aldosterone? It is a hormone. More specifically, what kind of hormone? No, it's not a neurohormone. What kind of hormone is aldosterone? Based on its name. It's a steroid hormone, aldosterone, right? So it's a steroid hormone. Where is it released from? The adrenal glands. What specific part of the adrenal glands? The what?
Medullary medulla.
Not the medulla. The medulla, what does the medulla release? Epinephrine and norepinephrine. The cortex is where you have aldosterone released, along with other steroid hormones, right? Among the steroid hormones, aldosterone is an example of what subdivision, subcategory of steroid hormones, based on how it functions. What does it function as? It's a mineralocorticoid. It's a corticoid because it's released from the cortex of the adrenal gland. It's a mineralocorticoid because it's in charge of homeostasis of sodium and also hydrogen ion. But it's really all based on sodium. So aldosterone is often called the salt-saving hormone. Salt-saving because it has the effect of reabsorbing sodium from the tubular fluid, keeping it for the body rather than allowing it to go into the urine. Well, the adrenal cortex is what secretes aldosterone. Now, there was the answer, by the way, to your question, to my question. There's three ways, the three black arrows at the top show you three ways independently in which the adrenal cortex can be stimulated. It can be stimulated directly by either hyponatremia or hyperkalemia. Well, what do those words mean? What is hyponatremia? Right, an abnormally low level of sodium ions in what? What does the emia part mean? In the blood, right. Words that end in emia means the blood has whatever the prefix indicates. So why is it hyponatremia? What is the nat part? The natter. It's from natrium, right? Remember I said that the Latin word for sodium is natrium, which is why its symbol is Na. So hyponatremia literally means too low a blood sodium ion concentration. That will directly cause the adrenal cortex to secrete aldosterone. So will hyperkalemia. And remember, kalium is the Latin word for potassium, which is why it gets the K symbol. So hyperkalemia means too high a blood level of potassium ions. That also will directly stimulate the adrenal cortex into releasing aldosterone. The third way is not direct. It's an indirect mechanism, and we've talked about this quite a bit already. Hypotension, which is what? Low blood pressure, abnormally low blood pressure, so that's an error signal, will cause the kidney to release renin, the enzyme that converts angiotensinogen from the liver into angiotensin 1, which then gets converted by angiotensin converting enzyme in the lungs into angiotensin 2, which then travels. Well, we've already talked about one of its effects, right? What's the major effect that we've talked about of angiotensin 2? What is it? No, angiotensin 2 is the final product. It is the active hormone. What does it do that we've talked about? How does it increase blood pressure, though? Where does it act? That we've already talked about, that is. Where? What we talked about was vasoconstriction, right? That's why it's called angiotensin. It tenses up the vessels. Angio refers to vessels, and tensin refers to constriction. So angiotensin 2 causes vasoconstriction in the vessels, which means the pressure is going to increase when you're squeezing on that fluid, right? Which is appropriate for hypotension. We talked about that effect. Here, though, another effect of that same stuff, angiotensin 2, is that it will cause the adrenal cortex to secrete aldosterone. So there's three different ways that aldosterone is being secreted here, but their causes are all related. The three different causes are all really related. If you have low blood pressure, it can be because you've lost too much water, right? Which might have happened because not enough sodium has been retained in the blood. Because remember, water follows sodium. So one way of curing that is to make sure you save that sodium for the blood so that water osmotically will follow into the blood. Does that make sense? Okay. So anyway, regardless of which of these three mechanisms causes the adrenal cortex to secrete aldosterone, aldosterone affects renal tubules in the kidney. And it causes, like I said, it's the salt-saving hormone, meaning saving it for the body. It causes increased sodium reabsorption. That means bringing it from the tubular fluid back into the blood. Well, immediately back into the interstitial fluid, but it makes its way into the blood as well. And since water follows, that means the urine is going to have a lower sodium ion concentration, and it's also going to be less watery. The volume is going to be down. Now, this is not negative feedback, strictly speaking, because this doesn't really do anything about increasing blood pressure. It just makes it keep getting worse, or it keeps it from getting worse. On the other hand, the red one is a true negative feedback loop. The aldosterone causes increased potassium secretion. So at the kidneys, whatever's happened to sodium, the opposite is happening to potassium. So as sodium gets reabsorbed, potassium gets secreted. That means taking it from the body, putting it into the urine, remember. So the increased potassium concentration in the urine means that you're going to decrease the amount of potassium that's in the blood, which was the original signal that caused its release. So that's true negative feedback, right? You get rid of the direct cause of the error, and that negates the error, diminishes it. Now to 9. The cell on the left is labeled as normokalemia, which means this cell is normal with respect to the concentration of potassium ions, right? Potassium and sodium are both very important in membrane potentials. If we're talking about excitable cells, which are what's listed here, these are cell bodies of neurons, so these are excitable cells, that membrane potential is even more important than in other cells, because these neurons are worthless if they can't fire, right? If they can't have action potentials, they're not really able to do their job. And therefore, an imbalance in potassium ions is the most dangerous of the ion imbalances. You could have an ion imbalance for any of the ones that we looked at in those graphs. But potassium is one that can be especially dangerous if it gets too far out of homeostasis. And so we have the two different extremes, both abnormal on the right in B and C. Hyperkalemia literally means too high a potassium ion concentration, right? Well, notice what happens here in response to hyperkalemia. If you look at the little circle, which is a graph of what's happening with the membrane potential, hyperkalemia leads to a depolarization of the cell. Recall from 201 that at resting membrane potential, which is what RMP stands for, that resting membrane potential is negative. It's below zero because the inner surface of the membrane has more negative charges on it compared to the outer surface of that membrane. And so the voltage across the membrane is negative with respect to the inside. That's how it is at rest, and therefore it's polarized at rest because one side is negative and the other side is positive. When the voltage goes up towards zero, we are depolarizing that membrane, right? Which you need to do in order to get to an action potential, because that threshold is more positive than resting membrane potential is. So depolarization means moving toward threshold and therefore moving toward the production of an action potential. In other words, more likely for that neuron to fire. Hyperkalemia therefore causes cells to be excitable cells, neurons and muscle cells. We're looking at neurons here, but the same would be true of muscles, to be more excitable. They're just very close to being threshold, so it doesn't take as much to set them off. And that can cause all kinds of problems, especially when you consider that neurons control the rest of the body. When they fire, when they're not actually supposed to fire, simply because they're more excitable because of the imbalance of potassium ions, then all kinds of bad things can happen. And if it's muscles that are being too excitable, well, those muscles will contract when they're not supposed to be contracting. And so this can cause, you know, all kinds of problems as well with breathing, with the heart. So it's bad news. Hyperkalemia, because of that excitability factor, is bad. The other extreme, though, is also bad. Hypokalemia, too low a potassium ion concentration, does just the opposite. Well, but before I get to that, let me explain why hyperkalemia causes this higher excitability. When there is a higher, when there's an elevated potassium ion concentration, then that means less of it diffuses out of the cell. All right? The higher potassium ion concentration in the blood, that's outside of the cell. That's represented by all these blue dots. When the extracellular fluid has too much potassium ion, which is not supposed to have a very high concentration of, right? Because they're being pumped into the cell continuously. So when there's too high a concentration outside, that means potassium ion concentration the gradient has been diminished. Because there's a lot inside the cell that got pumped in. If there's also a lot outside, then that's not a very steep gradient. Does that make sense? And therefore, fewer potassium ions end up diffusing out of the cell. Well, that leads to the upward swing in the voltage. The opposite situation is hypokalemia. When you have too low a concentration in the extracellular fluid, then that means even more than normal potassium ions diffuse outward. Those potassium ions are charged how? Positive. They're positively charged ions. They're cations. So when more than normal potassium ions, which are positively charged, leave the cell, that leaves the interior of the membrane even more negative because you're getting rid of positives. Does that make sense? When it's more negative, that's a downward swing in the graph of voltage. So hypokalemia causes hyperpolarization of the plasma membrane. Takes it farther from threshold, in other words, and makes it even less likely than normal that cell will achieve an action potential. So the cells are less excitable. They won't actually create an action potential, because even if something comes along to try to get them into an action potential, it's going to bring it up a little bit, but not even to threshold anymore, because you started lower than you normally would. Well, when neurons don't fire, that can be just as bad as when they're firing when they're not supposed to be. All right, now 11 or 10. In here, we're looking at a close-up of the kidney tubule. And then this specifically, where are we in the kidney when you see all these microvilli making up a brush border? What part of the renal tubule has the greatest concentration of microvilli making up a brush border? Right, the proximal convoluted tubule. That's where we are specifically here. And what's illustrated here is how the kidney deals with hydrogen ion concentration increase in the blood. If we have a higher than normal hydrogen ion concentration in the blood, what condition is that? Too high an hydrogen ion concentration. What do you know that as in general? When there's a high hydrogen ion concentration, what do we say of that stuff? It's acidic, right? So the problem here is that the blood has become too acidic. This shows you how the kidneys deal with that. Now, you have three compartments here: the blood, the intracellular fluid of the renal tubule cells, the epithelial cells, and the lumen of the tubule, which contains the tubular fluid, of course. The stuff that all the arrows that are occurring in the middle, they seem to suggest that things are moving from one endothelial cell to the other. That's not what it means. That's just spread out so that you can see it. All of this stuff that's written on top of the cells is occurring in any individual cell. All right? Also notice, though, that some of these H's, which are the hydrogen ions, are colored so that you can trace what's happening to them. So the original problem is that there's too many hydrogen ions in the blood. You need to reestablish homeostasis with respect to acid-base in this case. Well, we've already talked about the important reversible reaction involving acid, right? So the hydrogen ion buildup in the blood means that some of these hydrogen ions are going to react with bicarbonate to form carbonic acid. That's happening in the blood, right? Carbonic acid then, on the other side of the equation, is going to... what we're doing is operating this right to left, as I've written it before. So hydrogen ions and bicarbonate ions combine to form carbonic acid, which then splits into carbon dioxide and water. The water, notice with the blue H, that water is now carrying the proton, or the hydrogen ion, from the blood. So it's not protons that directly get transferred through the cells. The protons or hydrogen ions get carried as components of other substances. In this case, water. The water and carbon dioxide both enter the cells of the tubule. The water through aquaporins, that's what this little symbol indicates. But the CO2 can diffuse right through the phospholipid bilayer, right? Just like at the lungs. Now we're inside the tubule cell. Now the CO2 that's coming in from the blood is just one source of CO2. This cell itself is also creating CO2 because it's using fuel by cellular respiration. The CO2 is being added. That's what this is. But also CO2, as we'll talk about in a minute, is coming in from the urine as well. In any case, you have CO2 and water in the cell now, in the tubule cell. And really just the reverse of what happened in the blood happens in the cell. So the CO2 and the H2O combine back into carbonic acid. Like I said, that's still within this cell. And then the carbonic acid... Oh, by the way, this won't happen easily unless you have CAH, which is what? Carbonic anhydrase, which is the enzyme responsible for this reversible reaction. So carbonic anhydrase in the tubule cell will combine CO2 and H2O into carbonic acid, which then splits back into hydrogen ions and bicarbonate ions. So now you have a hydrogen ion in the tubule cell that used to be in the blood, but it didn't go in there directly. It went in there via water. Okay, now on the brush border surface, which is which surface of the epithelium? Apical or basolateral? It's the apical surface. It's the free surface. It's the surface that is facing the tubular fluid. That surface features this red dot, which is functioning as what? An antiport protein, because it's a co-transporter that moves two different things in opposite directions. The two different things are sodium ions and the proton, hydrogen ion. So this thing operates by allowing sodium to come in down its gradient into the cell from the tubular fluid. Why is the concentration of sodium ions in the cell low so that it wants to come into the cell? Because sodium is being pumped by sodium-potassium exchange pump at the basolateral surface. So sodium is being pumped from the cell into the blood on this left side, which is the basolateral side. That creates a low concentration of sodium in the cell, so that sodium wants to diffuse from the tubular fluid on the right side into the cell. And when it does that, it exchanges a proton in the opposite direction. So that's how the proton that was in the blood and was part of water when it was in the cell now makes it into the tubular fluid. All right? By the way, when that happens, it doesn't remain as a hydrogen ion in the tubular fluid. It then combines with bicarbonate that has been filtered at the glomerulus and is in the tubular fluid to once again make carbonic acid. Carbonic anhydrase on the brush border, which is actually outside of the cell, then converts that into water and CO2. And the water that's in the urine at this point is carrying the proton that made the blood acidic to begin with. Does that make sense? It's not an overwhelming response. Are there any questions about it? Should I not proceed? Well, total lack of response means I will proceed. Let's go to 11 and look at a similar one. Now, that's the one we just looked at is the primary means by which protons get secreted into the urine or the tubular fluid. That's not urine at this point. That would be tubular fluid. It's secreted, though, because it's making its way from the blood into the tubular fluid, right? And it's the primary means is involving that bicarbonate buffer system, the reaction we keep talking about. That's not the only buffer system, though, chemical buffer system in the body. This one actually is very similar to the previous slide, and in fact, not all the details are shown, but all that same stuff is happening with respect to the blood and the cells. What's different here is what's happening in the tubular fluid. In the previous slide, notice that, or let me just quickly go back to it. Remember that the proton that gets antiported in exchange for sodium that gets put into the tubular fluid, that combines with bicarbonate in the urine, right? Well, there's only so much bicarbonate ion in the tubular fluid. So if you're still pumping protons out, the rest of them that don't have bicarbonate to bind to make carbonic acid, and then water and CO2 from that, would have to just be in solution as protons, right? Which is when they are actually causing the strong acidity. Well, that would be a problem because the antiporter only works if there's a steep enough gradient with respect to protons. If protons start building up in the tubular fluid, then this antiporter will stop operating. It can only move protons when there's enough of a difference between the cell and the tubular fluid. So it's important for all the protons to be combined with something else rather than just being protons alone. And that's where this secondary chemical buffer system comes into play. You still have the bicarbonate one operating, but when bicarbonate when you don't have available bicarbonate anymore and you still have protons coming into the tubular fluid, you use the one involving mono dibasic sodium phosphate and monobasic sodium phosphate. Na2HPO4, that's the symbol for what's called dibasic sodium phosphate. So it's a sodium, or it's two sodiums, hooked onto a phosphate. NaH2PO4 is monobasic sodium phosphate. What happens here is that the dibasic, the one with the two sodiums, loses a sodium and picks up a hydrogen that's coming out of the tubular cell. Well, that sodium that it loses is naturally going to go back into the cell and be pumped out the other side into the blood. But that absorbs the proton, keeping it from just being a hydrogen ion in solution. So that transforms dibasic sodium phosphate into monobasic sodium phosphate, which gets released in the urine. So in this case, one of the two H's in monobasic sodium phosphate is carrying the proton that used to be in the blood, keeping it from making the gradient so steep that the antiporter won't work anymore. So the two are happening at the same time. Go ahead.
Did you say dimonic? What was the second one?
This one's monobasic sodium phosphate. The one with one sodium and two hydrogens is monobasic. And that's what dibasic gets turned into when it swaps a sodium for a proton that it's picking up. And that's what keeps the proton from being just in solution. It gets incorporated into the monobasic sodium phosphate. 12. Well, this scale analogy is kind of a good way to talk about maintenance of proper pH, which we've talked about the importance of before. Most of the cells in the body have a normal pH of a little bit more than 7, so it's slightly acid, slightly basic. Now, there are exceptions, of course, right? The stomach is a glaring exception of that, which is highly acidic. That's the normal environment for the stomach. But the rest of the body, slightly alkaline, but notice that normal is only from 7.35 to 7.45. Pretty narrow range. And you get outside of that range, and you can be in trouble quickly, depending on how far out of the range. Too high a pH, though, means that you're in alkalosis. Too low a pH, you're in acidosis. Well, the body can't tolerate very much acidosis or very much alkalosis. If you get into these red ranges, which is not very far away, 6.8 is not very far from neutral, right? Just 0.2 notches down from 7. That will kill you quickly. Acidosis can kill you in hours. The extreme acidosis shown here, that will kill you in minutes. Same with too extreme an alkalosis. Only one notch up on the pH scale is way too much for the body to handle. And that's why it's so important to have these mechanisms in place to keep the proton concentration where it should be. And that's why this reversible reaction that we keep talking about, carbonic acid and bicarbonate, is so important. What you see by the scale, though, is that under normal circumstances, the ratio of bicarbonate to carbonic acid is very high. So to keep things in the normal range, you have a lot more bicarbonate ions than you have carbonic acid molecules. But that can be tipped. The whole thing operates as a buffer system, though, because carbonic acid is a weak acid. Strong acids are ones that completely dissociate, so they're going to give up their protons. All of them are going to give up their protons. In a weak acid, only a certain fraction, small fraction of the overall population of those acid molecules are going to be dissociated and give up their hydrogen ions. And this is why buffers are able to take on protons or get protons removed without changing the pH very much. A buffer is really just a combination of a weak acid and a weak base. The weak acid can donate some protons if the pH gets a little too low. the weak base can take on protons if the pH gets a little, I mean, just the opposite. If it's too acidic, the base can take some of those protons. If it gets too acidic, then the acid can give up some of those protons. That wouldn't happen with strong acids or strong bases because they would be totally dissociated. Slide 13. Well, more pictures of neuron cell bodies here under abnormal situations. This shows you the link between acidosis and hyperkalemia in both directions. But on the top, notice that acidosis can lead to hyperkalemia. And the reason for that is if you have acidosis, that means the extracellular fluid has too high a proton concentration, hydrogen ion concentration, right? Too many H pluses outside. So many that some of them are going to diffuse into the cell more than would normally happen. Well, they are positively charged, right? So they're coming down their concentration gradient by going into the cell, but they're carrying charge with them, so that disturbs the charge separation, and therefore to make up for that charge disturbance, positively charged potassium ions leave the cell in exchange for the protons that are coming in down their gradient. This allows the cell to maintain charge neutrality, but it disturbs the balance of potassium, right? Well, if potassium ions are leaving, then what you have is hyperkalemia because those potassium ions are being dumped into the extracellular fluid. So hyperkalemia, well, and into the blood eventually as well, once you're into the extracellular fluid. So that's why acidosis leads to hyperkalemia, because these potassium ions are being exported from the cell in response to the diffusion into the cell of protons. Now, does that make sense? Okay, that's the word I was wanting. Just the opposite on the bottom. Alkalosis is the opposite problem compared to acidosis, right? Too high a pH. Well, that means that the extracellular fluid doesn't have enough protons in it. And what's going to happen there is that protons that are in the cell and that are bound to proteins to keep them out of solution, basically, they will dissociate from those proteins in order to diffuse out of the cell to be in the extracellular fluid where they're in too low a concentration at the moment. Okay? When that happens, once again, you have a charge disturbance. It's just in the opposite direction. So to maintain the charge neutrality, potassium ions then enter the cell to replace the positive protons that are leaving the cell. And that causes just the opposite problem. Now the extracellular fluid has too low a concentration of potassium. That is hypokalemia. We already discussed that hyperkalemia and hypokalemia are both really bad conditions. Well, in the final slide, I think this is the final slide, we can see that acidosis and alkalosis can both individually be categorized as either respiratory or metabolic. Now, I haven't talked as much in this chapter about the respiratory system's contribution to acid-base maintenance, but we've talked about that in the respiratory system chapter, right? It's that same exact reversible reaction that the kidney uses that we just looked at in those two slides that I spent a lot of time on, but it's a different system using that, right? The respiratory system actually drives that reaction in one way or the other by the rate of ventilation, right? Like I said, when you hyperventilate, you're breathing more than you should be and therefore getting rid of too much CO2. If you're taking away CO2 from that reversible reaction, that means it's going to go toward the left, which means hydrogen ions and bicarbonate ions are going to combine to form bicarbonate, which then will split into CO2 and water. The CO2 replaces the CO2 you're blowing off. Well, That means you're now taking hydrogen ions out of solution, which does what to the blood? To the pH. It makes it more basic, right? So that hyperventilation leads to respiratory alkalosis because you're taking those hydrogen ions out of solution. On the other hand, holding your breath, hypoventilation, or just breathing too slow, or if you have a defective lung and you just can't ventilate enough, that's going to have the opposite problem, right? It's going to lead to a buildup of CO2 because you're not blowing it off. That CO2 is going to react with water to form carbonic acid, which will split into bicarbonate and hydrogen ions. So you're adding hydrogen ions to the extracellular fluid. That leads to respiratory acidosis. Well, metabolic acidosis and alkalosis just has to do with stuff that's happening in the cells rather than how you're breathing. And so that's the fundamental difference. Metabolic acidosis can be caused by various things, but for instance, a production of organic acids that can occur in diabetic patients. Also starvation. You've probably heard about if you fast for a very long time, you will enter ketosis, right? You make ketone bodies that leads to acidosis. That's an example of metabolic acidosis. On the other hand, you can become metabolically alkalotic, undergo metabolic alkalosis, if you have uncontrollable vomiting or diarrhea, where you're getting rid of protons at too high a rate. Right? It's going to leave the pH too high, which is alkaline. Well, you don't want to mess around with pH, like I said, when we had that scale figure, because it doesn't have to be tweaked very far for things to go very bad. You need to keep it in that 7.35 to 7.45 range. All right, that's done, and it looks like we're close enough not to bother starting another one.